5% of those incarcerated in our prisons will return to communities across our state. It is also important to recognize that there is an integral connection between our state's policy and bonding. Last year, we passed the Minnesota Rehabilitation Reinvestment Act, which, by virtue of that policy, connects the work of transformation, the work of rehabilitation, to public safety. And I think as we walk through this, we will show and demonstrate the ways in which bonding and policy are critically connected. Turning to the two DOC bonding requests, you should have a one-page summary of our requests in your materials. For those who have toured the facilities, it will not be surprising that our first priority is asset preservation. The numbers on this slide speak for themselves. Of the deferred maintenance needs of all assets managed by state agencies, 33% of a need, a full one-third, is within the Department of Corrections. The estimated cost of improving all DOC infrastructure to just fair condition is $723 million. Currently, the department has 16 buildings that are in crisis condition and 61 buildings in poor condition. As I'm sure you've heard many times in this committee, when maintenance is deferred, it only grows more expensive. Just 2 years ago, the estimate was $631 million. It has grown by $92 million in the last 2 years. This significant cost is due to the age and complexity of these facilities. Prisons encompass many aspects similar to an entire municipality, including healthcare clinics, water, sewage infrastructure, housing, grounds to maintain, classroom spaces, food services, and recreational spaces. They also include extensive and complex security systems that require ongoing maintenance for safety and security of the facilities themselves. As I've mentioned, the context cannot be overlooked that these facilities are 24/7 living environments to over 8,000 souls. We must maintain spaces that are conducive to health, safety, and rehabilitation. However, I ask that you turn your attention to the roughly 4,000 individuals also who work in the state of Minnesota correctional facilities. Work in correctional facilities is among the most challenging in our state. And the work is not without risk. They are correctional officers, nurses, teachers, case managers, reentry staff, facility maintenance crews, and professionals who provide treatment, ranging from sex offense treatment to substance use disorder treatment. We ask a lot of our staff, and on top of that, they endure harassment, and risk in the correctional environment is real. And the hours and stark separation from loved ones can be very difficult after long shifts. And then there are the physical spaces in which they work. I understand that we're talking about prisons, but I ask sincerely, how might we feel working in these environments, given the upkeep and space challenges we face? As an employer, we must be a more attractive place to work in pay, and we've made some progress here, in work culture, and we've made progress in this space as well, and in the environment where our staff does the work on a 24-hour basis. That is one of the areas that we face considerable challenge. These prisons are stark and challenging, hard to live in, certainly, but very hard to work in. Jobs in corrections are already very challenging by their nature. Each of the individual project requests are designed to efficiently use staff, unlike many current spaces, and create safer and secure environments for everyone. Safety and wellness of state correctional staff must be a priority. Prioritizing their safety and wellness not only benefits the staff, but when our staff feel valued, it translates to improved services to the incarcerated. The significant deferred maintenance levels of the DOC are not just issues of crumbling walls and leaking roofs. They directly impact facility safety. For instance, we have prison cell doors so old they must be manually secured by key, and in many cases, sight lines prevent safe observation of movement. The State Correctional Facilities Security Audit Group has raised repeated infrastructure issues of concern for the safety of staff and incarcerated individuals. Often, our response to the audit group is concurrence with their findings and recommendations. And yet, we almost always cite that higher priority needs and bonding needs are limitations to their recommendations. Members, as you can see, here are examples of our need. We could have filled this entire presentation with similar examples from all 11 facilities. A significant challenge is the level of need and prioritizing projects. Just last fall, lead and other metal compounds were found in the drinking water of two facilities. We have since shifted priorities to address this critical issue. A few years ago, a large portion of bricks on the outside of a building at Faribault Prison fell off. We dedicated funds to repairing that and pushed other projects down the list. We will continue to meet those challenges and prioritize projects, but let me assure you, every bit of asset preservation funding you provide the DOC will be used to address critical infrastructure projects as efficiently and effectively as we can. These photos do not provide the full story. So we made significant efforts to have legislators come into the prisons recently. And over the last year, we have hosted 25 legislative tours. Having 25 members of the House and Senate and over 55 members of legislative staff inside the walls and razor wire to see the work conditions firsthand. Moving on to the second portion of the department's request, a critical expansion of rehabilitative space at the prison at Rush City. For reference, there's a separate handout in your material summarizing this project. Members, before I speak to this project and the need for this space, I want to address why all of the previous DOC bonding projects did this one make it to the governor's bill. We've had previous projects at prisons in Faribault and Lionel Lakes that have even received design funding in the past. Those projects are not included here. And it is with great intention that this one is. The need for this project is urgent. Since the prison was built 24 years ago, the state of Minnesota has not effectively engaged the high-risk men incarcerated there to improve public safety outcomes, to reduce recidivism, to reduce crime, nor has it done enough to mitigate the intergenerational impacts of incarceration as the men are warehoused there instead of rehabilitated. We cannot risk continuing the impacts of past mistakes in prison design at this facility. We also cannot afford to only receive design funding in the bonding bill and risk a future legislator not moving the full project forward. We know how difficult this is politically. It's hard to invest in prisons, but a missed opportunity to better for the sake of public safety will persist. Throughout my time as commissioner, it has become crystal clear that the severe lack of space at Rush City has resulted in lost opportunities to improve outcomes. Let me explain. Members, when the prison was designed, the intention for it was to be single bunked. And even then, it was also intended to have more programming space than was eventually built. However, before it was opened in 2000, the decision was to make it a double bunked facility, meaning twice as many men incarcerated there. And with programming space for less than half of the people who live there. This lack of space for rehabilitative programming creates something of the worst practice in correction, an idle population. Idleness means incarcerated individuals are not participating in program. They are essentially warehoused. Today, almost 1,000 men are incarcerated at Rush City, and a full third of them are entirely idle. Many more have some level of programming, but need much more. Not only are critical opportunities for transformative and rehabilitative programming missed, like education, sex offender treatment, substance use disorder treatment, mental health, and job training, It makes the prison less safe for everyone who lives there and works there. And those who sit idle during their incarceration are more likely to offend when they're released, not less. The prison in Rush City has the highest rate of idleness in the DOC. This prison should have been built differently. And I ask this committee to consider righting the past wrong. We now know better. And we have the data and we have the experience. And we make no mistake that the prison in Rush City isn't going anywhere. An expansion will be used for decades to come. It is our newest facility. It is also one of the three level four or max level prisons that we have in this facility, with the other two being over 100 years old. Based on the state's criminal code and the functioning of our system, there is no doubt that the men will continue to be incarcerated at Rush City as it stands, likely warehoused there. Moving on to the significant loss opportunities that this space lacks and its impact on public safety, I'd like to explain briefly a well-known best practice in corrections known as the RISC principle. The RISC principle is simple but central to effective corrections. To create the most of benefit, we must invest in those with the highest levels of risk. Members, those who are incarcerated at Rush City have some of the highest risk levels in our system, yet providing them rehabilitative services is limited. You can see here that over 200 men at Rush City do not have a high school equivalent. Providing this level of education is required of the DOC, subsequently using up all classroom space, so we offer virtually no vocational or post-secondary education there. And even when we use all the classroom space for GED services, the wait list for these services is still extensive. To reiterate, the DOC is not able to provide post-secondary education at Rush City, despite the fact that the state can take full advantage of federal Pell funding now available to incarcerated students. Well over 50% of the population of the prison require behavioral health treatment, yet the facility has just two small rooms for appointments, and our therapy staff have challenged finding space for these appointments. Over 200 men are on wait lists to receive sex offender treatment, and this is a critical need for reducing risk. I would be remiss if I did not name that the prison has some of the worst racial disparities in our state prison system, which is a sobering fact, as we all know how incredibly stark disparities are in our prisons. At Rush City, 55% of the men are Black, 7% are Native American, and we must do better. Members, in closing, I will say it again, 95% of those who are incarcerated will return to communities across our state. We are safer, and our communities will be if they return to their communities successfully through rehabilitation. And critically, their families will be better off. Thank you for the opportunity to present the DOC's two requests. It is the nature of our work in corrections that it is oftentimes out of sight and too often out of mind for many in the public. Behind the brick walls and the razor wire, the people who are incarcerated and those who work in our facilities are often hidden. In the most basic sense, our prisons are where the failures of society, the unaddressed traumas, and the impossible challenges for our governments are hidden. Whether it be the failure of education and child welfare systems, mental health access, economic opportunities, disparities, or racist systems, our correction system is left with these challenges and are expected to produce better outcomes. Your interest in those outcomes and conditions of confinement can make a huge difference. We are not ignorant to the political realities on both sides of investing in prisons, but outcomes of incarceration matter, as do the well-being of our staff, the incarcerated population, their families, and most importantly, the safety of our communities. And with that, both myself and Carl are available to answer any questions you or the committee may have.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your passionate words. I'm a strong supporter of the reform proposal, and I share a sense of frustration that this prison wasn't, this new prison relatively 25 years ago was not built properly. I also have a frustration about how long it takes to do the pre-design, do the design, get the construction documents, get the environmental review, get the architects to approve it. It just seems like I feel a sense of urgency, and if there's anything we can do that can help move that process along so that, you know, we can get this done, please do let us know, and maybe Mr. Hunt has some ideas for us. And have you done anything at all to start looking at pre-design for Rush City?
The process is...
Mr. Hunt, just reintroduce yourself at the tape.
I'm Carl Hunt, Capital Resource Administrator for the DOC. Members, the process is a longer process for us. We do use the design bid build process. So all of our projects are going to go through full design. So we're going to solicit and bring on a designer to complete our design 100% construction ready. And then we're going to resolicit for a contractor to perform the work and finish the project. So it takes a little longer, but it allows us to be more thorough. Our security requirements and security elements of our projects mean that our design has to be bulletproof and solid and well thought out before we begin execution, so we don't have any mistakes throughout the project. So it does take time. I understand that it looks like it takes a lot of time.
And you have to keep operating the prison
exactly
while you're doing all this. So is the idea to build an addition? Is that what the plan would be?
The Rush City includes approximately 16,000 square feet of remodeling space that'll happen over six or seven different phases. The phases are a necessity to keep that continuity of that operation going. In conjunction with that, there's around 30,000 square feet of additional that will be added on to that. We're replacing a trailer, an overflow trailer that mm-hmm. we have out back that has been brought in for programming. Spaces are really cramped. We really look forward to starting the project.
So it's on existing land that you already have?
It's right. On existing land, yep.
And then will you have to reduce the population during this process?
This does not affect the living units. So the living units will remain unaffected, and the guys can reside within the units as we normally would. It's going to have an impact or a partial impact on programming. However, we're already so handcuffed on programming at this facility that I don't see that to be a huge compromise. It's going to be phased out, and that's all going to be worked out through the design. Another reason the design takes so much longer is to create the phases and design around impact. Mm-hmm.
So how long do you think this will take then? Will it be a year or 2 years to do the whole design construction document before you can actually start building?
Realistically, it's safe to say that from the point we start to pull together that RFP to put out to bring a design firm on, the design firm gets assembled and goes through design, we're probably right at about a year. I would mm-hmm. say 10 months to a year to design that. A few more months for solicitation of a contractor, processing, notice to proceed, and then we could begin actual construction.
Can you put it out for design in June? As soon as we adjourn here, so you can get going?
I can put it out for design as soon as we have appropriation, funding appropriation numbers.
Maybe we should put it in the modifications bill. Just kidding. Commissioner Shaw.
And Madam Chair, I understand the concern, and we share that, and we understand that you want to see the dollars allocated to get in, put into use as quickly as possible. And I think one of the concerns we have, and as you know, we have shifted some of our priorities because we have some sites where there, you know, we do have some projects that are ready. But I think, as you know, because there has been challenges around getting dollars for the bill side of that, that we have ready projects, but we don't have the dollars to complete them. And so I think with Rush City, one of the concerns we have is, you know, we move into this. And because of the criticality of the need there, I think the concern is if we just do design and we don't have the dollars, we will be in a position where we can't move this project forward. And I think that's the biggest and deepest concern.
Yeah.
And anytime And anytime we pause on a project like that, we lose that momentum. Mm-hmm. So if we table that project for 2 years, say we design that project in full, and then the construction appropriation's not there, we're going to table it into the next biennium and request construction dollars. The design team kind of goes away. Everything just kind of loses the momentum of going through. Or as if we design all the way through, that same design team stays on as a consultant during the construction execution as an expertise throughout that, helps us manage the project. Everything flows so nicely when it's a fully funded construction project versus a partial design and construction at a later time.
Thank you. That's important to hear. Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Oh, sorry about that. Should I ask for questions first before I open my big mouth? All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner, Mr. Hunt. And
thank you.
Next on the agenda is the Department of Public Safety. And please just introduce yourselves before you speak for the purposes of the tape.
Chair Pappas, members of the committee, I'm Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of Public Safety.
I just saw you recently.
Yes, you did. I'm glad you welcomed me back. Thank you.
Welcome.
With me today are Superintendent Drew Evans from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and Lieutenant Colonel Christina Bogoyevich with the Minnesota State Patrol. Thanks for having the Department of Public Safety here to present our capital budget items. We appreciate it very much. Before we move on to the new projects, I just wanted to give you a quick update on the funding that this committee has provided to us from the last session. What you see in front of you on the slides today are the new State Emergency Operations Center located in Blaine. And so you can see your money is going to work. We are in progress in that build. And as you can see, the walls are going up. The snow is gone, but the walls are going up, and that's a good thing. And we expect the building to be completed in late May of 2025. So we're progressing, I think, even perhaps more swiftly than we thought we would. Just a quick overview of what you're going to hear today is a capital budget request and the governor's bonding bill for the Department of Public Safety. The governor and lieutenant governor put forward a very strong proposal to help address current issues and the future needs for public safety in Minnesota. DPS's law enforcement divisions serve every community in Minnesota, and building a new lab in Mankato will help evidence turnaround overall in Minnesota. All of these projects look to address public safety throughout the entire state. The three projects that we'll look at today, number one is the building a new Southern BCA regional office and laboratory. Second item that we'll talk about is purchasing land for and designing an expansion of the BCA Bemidji Regional Office. And the third item that we'll talk about today is purchasing land and designing a Minnesota State Patrol headquarters. And so to provide you with more detail on each of these projects, I will first turn it over to BCA Superintendent Drew Evans. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As the Commissioner noted, I am Drew Evans, Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As the Commissioner noted, two of the projects in the Governor's bonding recommendations to you involve two facilities at the BCA. The first, the need for this going forward is really to address the critical need of laboratory space that we have. Our headquarters location, which is located here in St. Paul and is our largest facility at about 225,000 square feet, houses approximately 540 people currently when we're fully staffed, which we're working on at the moment. That facility was designed for 366 people. And in particular, our laboratory that occupies the third floor of the building is completely out of space. And so in order to meet the current and emerging needs for our law enforcement partners, courts, prosecutors, victim advocacy groups across the state of Minnesota, we are in need of additional facilities. One of the things that's driving this in particular is our DNA laboratory. When I started at the BCA, there was 20 or so DNA scientists in our laboratory. We have over 60 now that are doing that type of work. It is considered the gold standard of forensic science, but it's one of many labs that we operate at our facility. We now have testing turnaround times that are required by law for our sexual assault examination kits, or we need to report to you on the progress that we're looking at. Digital evidence 10 years ago wasn't even a thing. When I started at the BCA, we had one agent that did digital evidence examination, computers, phones, et cetera, associated with our cases. It was a part-time position for one of our agents that they did that. Today, we have 22 digital evidence examiners, and our facility was not built for that purpose. The expansion in Bemidji and our new Southern Minnesota Regional Lab, if funded, will have specialized space that will be able to do those examinations. As we've seen with our forensic evidence, it's grown exponentially, 200% increase over the last decade. We saw a significant increase in DNA over the last few years as we saw a spike in violent crime in the state of Minnesota. While that spike, thankfully, is coming down and is moving the right direction, we have been remarkably accurate with our prediction for the caseload for our laboratory that you see here, and that is the criticality of this project. If we don't start building the southern facility now, we will be in a position of when we need to add additional staff to keep up with the demand that we will have no space to put them. These are just some examples, and I'll go through very quickly. These are in your packets. In addition, this particular handout is in your packet that outlines the projects themselves. As you can see on the right hand, you see a gun range that's used for testing evidence. That's not a gun range for practice. We have boxes, other storage that are in that location that really should not be there. This is what we're looking to. As we say, we're over capacity by over 150 people for workstations at our St. Paul location. You were generous and provided us funding to build out the last remaining space at the BCA last year. That will get us 43 additional workstations, but that still leaves us about 100 short, which is what we are recommending for these facilities. As you can see, when we've looked to maximize the space, we have our professional staff in cubicles as small as we can make them. They're 6x6, and we've maximized the footprint within that facility. As you can see, we're sharing offices. On the left-hand side of my screen, as I look at it, I think the same for you. That's what a NIBIN location. That's a National Integrated Ballistics Information Network. That's how we correlate cartridge casings to recovered firearms to provide leads to our partners. As you can see there, it's a very cramped space. We purchased three additional of these machines to combat violent crime in Minnesota, and we need additional space for that. We have some offices on the right-hand side that are designed for one individual agent that are being shared by three right now. So the recommendation is to complete the Southern Minnesota Laboratory and construction. Madam Chair, I heard your frustration with the process, but we have done what we can with this in terms of you provided us funding to purchase land and authority to purchase land and design process, which is out for RFP right now. We're in the process of selecting a vendor for the design. The pre-design has been completed for this facility. The reason the recommendation for a new building is it really has to do with laboratory space. It requires specialized HVAC, redundant electronic systems, coolers, freezers, space, as you can see in the handout, that's specialized for our laboratory equipment. And so through the pre-design process, it was determined that occupying another facility and upgrading it was cost prohibitive. In other words, building a new building that was purpose-built was actually the most cost-effective manner to do that. We have purchased the land. We own it in Mankato. It's next door to the Justice Center, next to our law enforcement partners, and across the street from our state patrol partners, so we would all be located in the same complex as we work in the southern part of Minnesota. This is an example, as you can see, just of the laboratory space and why it's specialized space that you can see from there. For Bemidji, this facility has been operating for the past 21 years in Bemidji, Minnesota. It's an excellent facility, but it is about half the size of the suggested facility in Mankato. We are seeking this year to purchase. I touched something I shouldn't have, I'm sorry. We are seeking design funding for that as well to continue that process along, much like Mankato, and authority to purchase land in that's adjacent to our property there. The reason for that is that our facility right now is very landlocked in where it would be for expansion. It would be very disruptive to our operations, and it would prohibit future expansion at that location. So purchasing that land would create the least amount of disruption to those facilities facilities while we're doing that, and would allow us future expansion into the future. Same thing there. We've had significant volume and complexity of our investigative and laboratory analysis at that location over time, and we find great, wonderful employees that do our laboratory work. We have a great partnership with Bemidji State University, much is the reason why we seek Mankato, being a centralized location with the university, a state university system that we'd be able to draw employees to from there. Part of the other thing that I didn't mention is the security that goes along with these facilities, which is why we seek these standalone law enforcement laboratory facilities. On the right-hand side of your screen, that's a CODIS room. That is our national DNA database. Our staff, because of security, can't even access those systems at their own desks. Even though we have a lot of security, they need to go to a standalone system to protect that information. This is just an example of a footprint that we're looking at for Bemidji and where we'd be looking at there. That is the pre-design as enacted. A new pre-design is underway that would contemplate purchasing that additional piece of land. That land is owned by the city, and they are interested in selling it to us for that, which would keep us in a good location. I know, Madam Chair, we're tight on time today, and I appreciate all the time you've all spent talking to us about some of these projects, both today and in different meetings. I would close by saying there's widespread support for this. It would create a training facility in southern Minnesota as well. The BCA trains about 8,000 to 9,000 students through our programs every year, and we consistently hear we need to bring those programs to them. We create a drop-off point for evidence in southern Minnesota. They wouldn't have to drive or mail evidence to our facility in St. Paul. And that widespread support amongst our law enforcement partners remains strong, but also with our victim advocacy coalitions. In your packet, you should have a letter of support from those coalitions, because one of the things that we've been working on to improve our turnaround times is that with our victim advocacy coalitions, that every day that a victim survivor waits for the analysis of evidence in their case that's being worked by our local law enforcement is a day that that victim survivor doesn't have answers. And so it's critically important to keep those turnaround times where they need to be. And this project is a critical component of being able to achieve that. And with that, I will turn it over to the Lieutenant Colonel on the State Patrol headquarters.
Just a minute, Superintendent. So with the Bemidji office, it's I didn't realize that was just design and land purchase. How much do you anticipate then the full cost will be for the building?
So the full cost for that building with the $4 million, I believe, is about $38 million to complete that with that.
Additional or including?
Additional, Madam Chair. And the reason for that is it's about doubling. It's about 24,000 square feet, 28,000, somewhere in there at the end of the day we need to add. All of the HVAC systems and the heating systems will need to be replaced as part of that to accommodate the larger building. So there are some increased costs that will go along with that, which raises that price tag. It's not exactly half of, say, building the Mankato facility.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for the superintendent? All right, then proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Christina Bogoyevich, and I serve as Lieutenant Colonel for the Minnesota State Patrol. I'm here to give a brief overview on the recommended $22.5 million for the State Patrol to acquire land and design new building space. This would take six antiquated metro offices and combine them into one modern office space along with garage space. This would allow us to build synergy and promote collaboration between our headquarters staff, our district leadership staff, between our crash reconstruction specialists and our investigators, and ultimately it would increase our accountability. So with that, we're going to move through some slides. I understand many of you did tour this or have seen some of the spaces we're working out of, so I'll be very brief in that. As you can see, the six sites here, two of them are over in Golden Valley, one up in Shoreview, one over in Oakdale, our central headquarters in St. Paul, and then our commercial vehicle sites down in Mendota Heights. This is our headquarters up here, and as you can see, there's no signage. It's not a welcoming site. There's no reception area when someone walks in, and there's also no free parking. I've sat on several interview boards as we hire staff into central headquarters, and I think on every one, at least one person has called stating that they'd be late because they couldn't find parking or they had to park 2 to 3 blocks away to get to the office. You can see the office site, on the side there. We don't have ample storage facility within central headquarters, so we often end up stacking stuff inside the office space. This is our East Metro. This is one of the sites that people did visit. As you can see on the left there, we refer to it as the family table. If you've lost a member of your family in a fatal crash, oftentimes when the investigator plans to meet with you, they'll bring you into this lunch table. However, if you work in the East Metro District office, that's also where you have lunch. And if you're a trooper in that district, that's also where you put all the evidence, where you can piece it out before it goes to the investigators in the district. On the right there, that's just another example of evidence and evidence storage and the space that we lack. Last year, we were lucky enough to get funding for CLIA accreditation. And as we stand right now, we would not pass evidence handling as part of that accreditation due to space. This is our West Metro office space.
Excuse me a minute, Lieutenant Colonel. Senator Dibble.
You just might want to pause and explain what CLIA accreditation is.
Yeah, so the...
Lieutenant Colonel Christina.
Sorry. Madam Chair.
Bogojevic?
Bogojevich.
Bogojevich. I was really off. So,
Madam Chair, Senator, the accreditation is 181 standards that are nationally accredited standards that we plan to meet within the next 3 years. We have signed on with the organization, it is CLIA, and we have started that process, and as we have dug into it, we knew we had inadequacies with our evidence and our evidence handling and our evidence storage, but as we've dove deeper into what those standards are, we have a lot of work to do.
So, Madam Chair, that was
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was an important initiative in the transportation bill that we all voted for last year. We provided a multi-year funding for the agency to pursue this accreditation, which would have a lot of benefits, not the least of which is, you know, really bringing our State Patrol up to national standards of excellent service and of stewardship of public funds. And part of that, of course, as we are hearing, has to do with facilities.
Right, that's why it sounds like they need new facilities to complete that. Okay, continue, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is our West Metro office. You can see there we have the same family table. On the right side there is in our commercial vehicles office. You can see some commercial vehicle brake chambers along with some defensive tactics training gear. This new space would actually allow a garage space to pull a commercial vehicle in to do a comprehensive inspection all in one. Again, commercial vehicles play a huge role in traffic safety, and so that would allow for, like I said, a comprehensive investigation rather than piecemealing brake chambers into a classroom. Again, we'll just touch on the evidence storage. You can see here the space we have is not adequate. It doesn't provide the adequate locking mechanisms to keep people out. And so we also have safes in there where we have to store our firearms. And vehicle storage. MnDOT's been very nice to us and allows us to park certain vehicles inside. But as we run into winter months and stuff like that, they also need that storage space. You can see on the right side here, that's our mobile response team unit, and we end up parking that outside in between two buildings at a MnDOT site. This is our West Metro storage. The picture on the left, our investigative crimes teams, when you think VIN swapping, things like that, we have evidence. We have to take cars in for evidence. We don't have secure space for that. So it often gets parked outside. On the right, with the red circle, that white car up there, that was actually a forfeited vehicle that someone came to the district office and stole back. And then our squads, if you're a trooper and you're involved in a crash in the winter, you have to go to this area, and as you can see there, thaw out another squad to use as a spare.
So, Lieutenant Colonel, did he steal his own car?
I'm not sure if he stole his own or if a friend came and stole his vehicle. Uh-huh. Again, this just goes into the deficiencies that we have, what we've had to do for air control in the evidence. As I mentioned, when you're storing drugs, you have to have a certain level of air quality in the workspace. So, and before we get to questions, I'm just going to hit on one more important piece for us, and that's the recruitment and retention of state troopers. There's no lack of discussion on recruitment of law enforcement out there, and when we start to talk about competing against other metro agencies, we're talking Minnetonka with their large building in Minnetonka. We're talking public safety facilities that we are competing against. When we have our informational sessions, we have to rent a classroom from Century College to bring people into. When we interview for state trooper, we bring them into a MnDOT facility with arrows on pieces of paper, leading them to a classroom where they'll interview to be a state trooper. It doesn't allow us to show who we are or the traditions we have or the culture that we want. And so this space really will allow us to build that and bring people in and to show them that they are a valued part of a pretty great agency. And with that, also we just signed on 2 years ago with 30 by 30, which is 30% female workforce by the year 2030. And so part of this would also to build a space where females, when they come back to work after having a baby, there is a space that, such as mothers' rooms, that will welcome them back, again, to show that we value them as part of our agency. With that, I will take any questions. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions? Great, then thank you very much to the three of you. And I understand you have another committee to visit.
I hope not.
Okay, I thought you did.
I think I'm okay for now, but thank
Madam
you.
Chair,
Senator Dibble.
We brought them in already, so
they've
already.
I just thought they were in a hurry because they had to go be at another committee.
Oh.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have the Department of Veterans Affairs. Welcome, and just please introduce yourself.
Chair Pappas, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I am the Interim Deputy Commissioner for Programs and Services, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today to offer our recommendations from the governor for capital investment for MDVA this year. So I'll start with the standard review of our mission, and I think that this is extremely pertinent given the services that we're providing to residents of our veterans' homes and the cemeteries services throughout the state. We run our state veterans cemeteries and homes. We assist nearly 30,000 veterans and their dependents, and we work to secure the available benefits and services that they have earned and deserve. And we truly are a statewide entity. We operate veterans' homes in the far northeast, far southwest, down in the southeast, and all the way up in Bemidji, which is where we were just at this morning, actually, coming back from visiting that new home. We also have office locations in Fargo and in Minneapolis and down at the Whipple Building. Talk quickly about the administration's approach to asset preservation. These are critical to how we developed our request, and these are with input from MMB admin and the governor and lieutenant governor. Not to belabor the point, but we believe that strong investments now reduce future costs. And this has been a point of pride for us in staying on top of asset preservation in particular as much as possible. Avoid those negative impacts in service delivery. We talk service delivery to Minnesotans, but we talk specifically about the residents of our veterans' homes. And then we work with the legislature to secure those assets and then administer those programs promptly, efficiently, and transparently. So every year that we have success in securing additional asset preservation dollars, we immediately swing into our work queue to identify those projects with the highest priority needs. And we typically are targeting those areas of the ones and twos. I assume you're aware of the crisis and poor ratings for facility condition audits. That is how we work through our process, identify those with the most critical life safety issues or those that are at issue or at risk of failure. And again, this is enterprise-wide, but in particular for the agency, ours, it focuses on those critical programmatic needs. We do our project starts depending on the volume of our projects. We have, at this point, we are seeking $12.8 million, and that is, again, to target those ones and twos that are critical in most of our campuses. We have been fortunate to receive funding for new homes in Bemidji, Montevideo, and Preston, so those are not included. However, our state cemeteries, especially the one at Little Falls, has been around for nearly three decades, and our veterans' homes, in particular Minneapolis, which has been in operation since 1886. So in essence, we are seeking the capital investment support for asset preservation. That is our primary request for this session. Those building systems and components that have exceeded their intended useful life. I did not bring a picture of the Bemidji home that you guys got to visit during your bonding tour to demonstrate what supporting MDVA does in terms of good products. But we would continue to welcome your presence at any of the veterans' homes or cemeteries as a review of the kinds of contributions and funding that would result in good outcomes. And briefly, just to recap, we are statewide, and we've got more than 1.4 million square feet, over 71 buildings, 12 of them have 24/7 operations, that total replacement value of $496 million. And I think critically in this point, you've heard it from us before, generally our asset preservation requests are not the glamorous requests. They are, as you can see, tuck pointing, repairing roofs, boilers, elevator repairs, windows and doors. And that backlog of asset preservation needs has been growing over the years in a way that we can barely keep up. So each year we are making a dent in our highest priority needs, but we have more than $116 million in deferred compensation, and of that amount, $53 million of it is critical. So this would go a long way towards securing some very significant investments. For your awareness, any projects that we identify that cost more than $400,000, we are able to submit requests to the federal VA for a reimbursement to do the matching grants for the construction. But most of these projects that we're seeking this session are not to that level. So the contributions and the support from the legislature are critical. And finally, the non-asset preservation is actually a consolidation of a grouping of asset preservation needs. Building 16 at the Minneapolis Veterans Home is actually our annex of the DOMS program that currently exists at Hastings. We do have this 50-bed facility at Minneapolis, and during our pre-design assessment, it was realized that rather than doing a piecemeal asset preservation on building systems, that a $16 million redesign would fund the full remodel of that building and continue to offer a safe and stable option for the residents who live there. Happy to answer any questions that the committee might have, and I am grateful for the opportunity to be in front of you today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. It just, my comments are just, we get very excited about new buildings. So we visited that new beautiful new facility in Bemidji. Yes. And then we appropriated the money last year for Hastings, but we're not taking care of the old buildings. And so we get this asset preservation backlog, and so there's a real difference in experience for our veterans, whether they're in a newer home or in an older one, I can imagine.
Chair, that's correct. And the focus, I think, a good example, especially at Minneapolis, is we have been successful over the last 15 years at overhauling that campus for the resident care, making sure that they have good amenities. But we have deferred maintenance on those staff facilities. Our building 10 at Minneapolis is our central healthcare offices and operations. Mm-hmm. That is also a 100-plus-year-old building, and we have focused on resident care to the expense of our staff, and we're at the point now where really making an investment in some of these old buildings is both, I mean, they're historic buildings, but it also is a work environment for our senior leadership on the healthcare team that they have been, they've been sacrificing their workspaces in order to secure that.
And that's building 16?
That building 10 is one of the asset preservation components. Building 16 is resident specific, but that building 16 does have residents in from the DOMS program, so.
So the asset preservation, the $12 million, would go toward Building 10?
It's spread throughout spread throughout all of our campuses, okay. But those with the highest need are the oldest buildings at the Minneapolis campus, which is historic. So,
great. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
And Director Kerr, welcome. Just kind of reintroduce yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. And Madam Chair, I'm here to brief you this afternoon on the governor's proposed portion or agency bills or agency projects in his bill, and then also give you an update on some of the stuff we're already working on. I want to thank the committee for their generosity. Really, in the last two bonding cycles, we've really received pretty much everything we've asked for. And that has been very beneficial for the agency in being able to work off some of the backlog that we had. I also need to mention that we're in the process of doing a reevaluation of our entire fleet of buildings right now. So a little over a decade ago, the Congress directed that we do something called the Readiness Center Transformation Master Plan. We can't do a briefing without a good acronym. So that's the RCTMP, Readiness Center Transformation Master Plan. And that actually caused us to do a review of all of our existing facilities along with the demographic trends and other conditions in the state to determine whether we were or were not in the right places in Minnesota and where we should be in the future. And we found that process very useful in identifying a long-range strategy for investment. And we also decided that it's probably time to refresh that. So we're in the process right now after 10 years of taking another look at that. And we will have that study completed by this summer. So we are somewhat tentative in our direction right now because we're reluctant to move forward on a 10-year-old plan before we see what the new plan looks like. But we do have projects in the bill. Two of those are recommended by the governor. The first is a total renovation of the Hibbing Readiness Center. And this would be a 50-50 state federal match. And the second is to provide what essentially is pre-design funding to get us ready to go into the Bloomington Armory. And I know, Madam Chair, you visited the Bloomington Armory. We think that's relatively indicative. And these fit into our strategy. Typically, we know we have to get into a building and do a roof and windows about every 20 to 30 years. So we have 63 armories on our inventory, which would indicate that we should probably be doing about three every year to be on pace to keep all of those in roofs every 30 years. And we're satisfied that we're on that path right now. And these are in line with that path. But again, we're somewhat tentative based on what the outcome of that study is going to be. But these are the projects in the governor's proposal. And Madam Chair, with that, I want to shift into some of the stuff we've been working on. So the first couple of projects were actually approved in the 2020 bonding cycle, and we are nearing completion on some of them and just starting one of them, because what we found was between the time that this initial bonding was approved and we started doing the construction, we had that massive spike in construction costs that caught us a little bit short. But we were able to come back to you last year and get supplemental funding, if you will, to be able to keep these projects on task. And we're nearing completion. Well, we've already completed one of them and nearing completion one, and just starting the third. So the Moorhead Readiness Center, we've been working on that now for about a year, and we're about to complete that. We anticipate moving back into that building in May of this year. So as you can see, we've expended or encumbered most of the funding that was approved for that job, and we will be looking very carefully at where we land that thing and be able to come back and tell you what's available for, I guess, to go back on the bottom line at some point. In addition to that, the Rosemont Readiness Center, which also we began that project on the 2020 bond proceeds with design funding and then got the actual supplement to the design funding and the construction funding last year. This one is just really going into demolition right now, so we're looking forward to getting this project done, but quite a ways to go on this thing, looking at August of 2025 to be complete. The Fergus Falls Readiness Center, we actually were able to complete, and we have been back in that since last May. There is money laying on the bottom line for that. We're not sure that entire $744,000 is available, but we think that we certainly will have a good feel for that in the spring to identify what may be there, but we're very satisfied that this project was done. This one actually came in a little bit under budget because the often we find a lot of pre-existing or unanticipated conditions when we go in. Whoever the contractor was when they built this thing did a really good job. So this This was really overdue for renovation, and when we got in, we found very few unanticipated conditions. So this was kind of a victory for us in getting through that process. The Marshall Readiness Center was the third project that we proposed in 2020 and got funding for. We were not able to move forward for that project because our shortfall was so great, and so we made a conscious decision to move forward with Moorhead and Fergus Falls. Initially, we had to do a little bit of supplementation out of our the base budget that we get, so that the legislature also gives us about $10 million a year in our maintenance appropriation that we'd use for general maintenance and for routine things. And our strategy has been to come back to the committee for bond proceeds when we need to do those major renovations. So we did dip into that a little bit to get started on particularly Moorhead and Fergus Falls, but Marshall, we were able to get the additional funding last year. I'm happy to tell you that we did the bid opening for this earlier this week, and we're in the process of getting the contract down on the street to the general contractor, and they will get a notice to proceed and start doing the demolition on this and doing the renovation. So we're still about a year and a half out on this. September 2025 is our anticipated time. The other project that we got funded last year is for an Army Combat Fitness Testing Field House that's going to be in Arden Hills on the federal property out there. We are moving forward as rapidly as we can. This is currently at the State Designer Selection Board right now, and that should come out of that process sometime in the late spring, and we should be able to get moving with design. Probably take about a year for the design to be complete, and then we'll go into construction, and we do anticipate opening this one in the summer of 2026. And an update on the Minnesota Military Museum. This is the most interesting one from my perspective because it was funded in three tranches. So we initially got $13 million in bonds in the 2020 cycle, and then the designer kind of led us to believe or opened our eyes to the fact that we needed more money to build the appropriate facility. And so we were able to come back, and the legislature was gracious enough to provide us a little bit of cash and, a lot of cash and a little bit of bond proceeds last year as well. So we're in the process of wrapping up the finality of the design of this thing. Design is supposed to be complete with bid documents this month, and then that should go out for the general contractor construction bid. But we are concerned about that 2020 bond proceed in this project and also the Marshall project, that we may not be able to obligate all those funds by the 31st of December of this year. And so we do think we need the extension on this project and the Marshall project from the 2020 appropriation. But we're pretty satisfied that we're going to have a wonderful facility when this comes to fruition. And with that, Madam Chair, I will complete my brief and stand for questions.
We knew you needed the extension on the Military Museum. We're just checking to make sure we have the Marshall
okay.
as well. We'll check on that.
Very good. We appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Any questions? Anyone? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate it. Nice to see you last night. I should clarify, it was at Duluth Days. I guess we should have done this next to corrections, but I know that the commissioner had to go to another committee anyway. So I'd like to welcome Margaret Zadra, the ombudsperson for corrections. And we have a report, which sounds familiar, crumbling conditions create crisis in Minnesota prisons. Welcome, and just once you get plugged in, you can just repeat your name for the tape.
Thank you. Yes, Margaret Zadra, ombudsperson for corrections. Thank you. Really,
you do have to be fairly close to the mic.
Okay, I'll repeat that. Margaret Zadra, ombudsperson for corrections. And we're good? Okay, great. Thank you. Really grateful to be here this afternoon to talk with you more about our report. The Office of the Ombuds for Corrections is separate and independent from the Department of Corrections. Our role is to investigate complaints from incarcerated people, staff, and community members, as well as investigate systemic concerns. We are able to facilitate resolutions, make recommendations, and publish reports, and provide education and information to help people navigate what is often a really complex and confusing system. Our statutory mission is to promote the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice in the administration of corrections. We really prioritize and work towards those items that promote equity and fairness, and are particularly interested in issues that affect health and safety and you know, those issues that affect the most number of people. This segues well into our report and why we're looking at systemic issues related to the infrastructure conditions within Minnesota prisons. You should have that report before you today. It is no surprise that we are talking about this and the under-resourcing within those buildings that are crumbling. We must be able to develop a strategy in order to dedicate resources to upgrade and maintain our current facilities, as well as looking at how we can replace facilities that are unsafe and cannot be adequately rehabilitated. You're probably really familiar with the 2020 OLA report that looked at safety in state correctional facilities. There was a chapter dedicated to infrastructure concerns, and a key recommendation in that report was the necessity for a strategy and funding to address the infrastructure and safety needs in Minnesota prisons. In particular, the report highlighted two of the highest needs facilities, Stillwater and St. Cloud. Stillwater pictured here, you can go all the way back. The first iteration of Stillwater was actually before Minnesota became a state, but is pictured here in the first version in 1908. The facility was moved then to the current location in 1914. However, you can tell the structure isn't all that much different than what it later became. In 1914, the picture there in 1950, not much of a change in update, and pictured currently, it really is no different. So the technology or the infrastructure, the plant setup was almost exactly was almost exactly as it was more than 100 years ago, which is particularly concerning for a number of reasons. St. Cloud, of course, it also has those open-tiered stacked cells that doesn't best serve public safety needs. The design features in both of those facilities are incredibly outdated, increasing the danger for incarcerated people and staff. And there's been, I don't want to discount some of the important updates and investments that have been made in both of those facilities over a number of years. We don't want to negate that work. A lot of them have been important capital investments there. But we do want to highlight how many needs have been unmet and the price tag that keeps going up. A 2014 study for replacing the prison in St. Cloud came with a price of $400 million. Due to inflation, that's likely a billion right now. Continuing to delay addressing the needs only continues to increase their cost. But it's not just St. Cloud and Stillwater that have significant needs. We are incredibly privileged to be spending time regularly in facilities, and we do have that independent lens that we're looking at these safety needs. And every facility, staff have shared, incarcerated people have shared, and we are able to see with our own eyes that every single facility has significant infrastructure needs that include, you know, leaking roofs, flooding water, not just from the roof leaks, pipes bursting and water coming up from the ground, significant water infrastructure needs and filtration needs. I live in a 100-year-old house, right? My water pipes have needs. This is and then you multiply by that by the hundreds and hundreds of people that are relying on the water that's coming into the facility every day. It is incredibly significant. Every single building has significant tuck pointing issues, both in interior and exterior walls. And oftentimes, there's either outdated materials or outdated mechanisms. We have heard from staff who are incredibly creative, and we are impressed at the ways that they're able to MacGyver some of the materials that they have. You know, that maybe something stopped being made 20, replacement parts stopped being made 20 years ago, and they're figuring it out, and that's really fantastic, and we want to acknowledge that creativity. It is not, however, sustainable. It is not efficient, and it does not best serve our safety needs. Across all 11 facilities, those infrastructure needs pose significant safety risks. Those loose and falling bricks or other structures that have fallen can cause significant harm to the people below them. They can become weaponized. Staff resources can be direct, you know, that should be used for security or programming needs are used for addressing these critical incidences as they come up. And of course, there's significant sightline concerns. When we're looking at future investments, we already heard a little bit about those significant deferred maintenance costs. I think it's also important to be really talking about where is the cost benefit there. We want to make sure that we're updating facilities and investing in the facilities that we have and where are the benefits of investing our resources there. But some of them are failing structures, so we're continuing to put money into them, and they are not best serving public safety needs. So where is that balance between evaluating the cost of perhaps investing in a new facility versus investing in failing structures? And I think it is so critically important that we are not just talking about things that are unsightly or rusty or, you know, frustrating to be around. The degraded prison infrastructure really takes an inhumane toll on the staff that work in the facilities and the incarcerated people that don't get to go home at the end of the day, and the communities that surround the facilities. What happens within the walls doesn't just stay there, right? It really affects public safety across the board in Minnesota. These unaddressed infrastructure needs lead to unsafe working conditions for staff and really contribute to staffing challenges. It is not surprising to hear that it's harder to staff facilities that have significant infrastructure needs. There's more forced overtime at those facilities, and more staff are needed to safely monitor those facilities. If you have a newer building that has better infrastructure, you can have fewer staff to safely monitor those. And it leads to increased stress and burnout and harder to retain those staff. It's pretty common that we hear from staff that they are able to go work at a new facility in a county make more money than they are in the state facility. That is a really common concern when I'm looking at retention. Also really leads to challenges for incarcerated people. We know that some of these infrastructure challenges have led to increased violence. We know there's increased stress and trauma for the people there, which does not promote safety, does not promote rehabilitation. And then, of course, we already heard today about that decrease in programming and opportunities for success. And also, then it lends towards unaddressed health needs. Across the nation, we know that incarcerated population have increased needs related to aging, chronic illness, mental health, substance use, and disabilities. We are also seeing that those increased needs in the population here in Minnesota. Our antiquated prison facilities are not equipped to house and provide the high level of care that is increasingly in demand for that population. And again, I really want to emphasize that we acknowledge and recognize some really creative and good efforts by staff and incarcerated people as well to manage a less than ideal situation in many of the facilities. However, as a state, we need to acknowledge that this has led, this under-resourcing has led to this public safety crisis within facilities. Uh-oh, I went way too fast there. All right. So our office within this report has made recommendations to prioritize significant resources to meet the safety and security needs that preserve health and human dignity for both staff and incarcerated people and the communities we serve. And there's some opportunities here to really look at how we're best utilizing resources. There's some opportunities for population reduction, which I know isn't likely the purview of this committee. And some, but some of this ties really into other policy needs, such as MRRA, which was recently passed. But there's a really significant need for a comprehensive infrastructure plan. And again, I'm really excited, I guess, to get to the end and get to your questions. What that comprehensive infrastructure plan looks like is ensuring that we're reviewing everything in totality. There may be some need and a consideration for a legislative task force to review or direct any plan of study. And we would really recommend and request that any review includes all DOC facilities. I think something that we've heard about from both legislators and staff is that oftentimes when we're prioritizing the highest needs, it's hard to really see the massive scope of the problem, and it really is massive. I think just these couple of pictures doesn't really get at how enormous the need is, and I think to have a full map and a full view of what's here and then look to priorities is incredibly critical in order to accurately address all those safety, security, and programming needs. And I don't know that we can do both addressing all those safety, security, programming needs without having that comprehensive infrastructure review. We add our voice to this conversation. I know many of you have been looking at these issues and concerns for years and years, partly because our staff are so regularly in facilities and see the real harm and human costs that come along with the financial cost that this delayed investment has had. So I stop there to answer any questions that you might have or any comments that you want to provide related to our brief report.
Thank you very much. That was very good timing to see this presentation to end and begin with the Department of Corrections and end with your presentation. Do any members have any questions? We certainly on the tour, we certainly, especially Stillwater, saw it's kind of shameful that we're still in this 100 plus year old prison, and that's the way we incarcerate people today. Yeah. So thank you very much for all your work on the report. We really appreciate it. We certainly are taking it to heart. And with the governor's proposal for Rush City and for asset preservation, you're being heard.
Thank you.
So, Senator Dibble.
Thanks, and thank you for the reports. Madam Chair, you and I have spoken in your office, and I think you've also expressed in some of these tours and other places just how gigantic and overwhelming this infrastructure issue is with our prisons. And I think when we went
could you speak a little louder and into the type, Senator Dibble?
Yeah. Can you hear me? When we went to Stillwater, I think Commissioner Schnell said if we were to replace this facility, I think as Ms. Audra mentioned, that's $1 billion, as we heard the same, I think, about Rush City. And you look around Stillwater and to fix it up, it seems kind of ridiculous because it's so out of date in terms of its design and how we, I don't know, it's a very big, overwhelming problem. And I remember Senator Latz, I mentioned this a few years ago, when the Department of Corrections came forward with a several $100 million infrastructure request to add more beds, had a thought of gathering up on a bipartisan bicameral basis, a bunch of folks, as well as multi-sector. Maybe you were part of that conversation. A little before your time. Okay. The thought was if we're going to spend $400 million or so, which was the ask at the time, can we look at using some of that money to address the underlying issues so we're not just simply adding beds? Can we go upstream a little bit, address the criminogenic effects of of what's going on in our institutions that aren't being addressed, that cause people to stay longer and or causes recidivism. doesn't allow people to access the kinds of treatment and education and other programs that allows people to get out early. And in a pretty robust package of recommendations came forward. And I think your thinking has been along those lines as well. Can we dust off some of that work and re-energize it and reinvigorate it? Because just simply fixing things and expanding prisons, there's no end to that. And plus, it's too big. So those are my thoughts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Sadra. So next week, this finishes our review of the governor's proposal and all the state agencies. So next week, we have the modifications bill up on Tuesday. The House has already posted their version. Ours will be very similar, might have a few additional items on it, and it'll be posted tomorrow if you haven't already seen it. And we hope that we'll be able to move that forward. Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's fine if you don't know this, but do you have any idea of when we would potentially see a corrections bill on the Senate floor?
I did talk to Leader Murphy about it, and there's no real reason to hold it up. We've announced many times and asked for people to give us their modifications. The House is moving. So I would imagine if we heard it on Tuesday and we passed it to Finance, it'd be reported on Wednesday. We can request they hear it in Finance on Thursday, and then I would think it could be up the following week. All right. Great. Any more questions? Then the committee is adjourned.